I have the great privilege and honor of introducing Dr. Naomichi Masaki, our next speaker. Dr. Masaki is the Associate Professor of Systematic Theology and the Supervisor of the STM program. He teaches dogmatics, Lutheran confessions, and the liturgy. And he was born and raised in Kobe, Japan. I've known Dr. Masaki for many, many years. The first time meeting him was in a classroom with Dr. Norman Nagel. And Dr. Masaki always showed great respect and honor to Dr. Nagel as he sat in the very front and diligently kept his notes. We both had the great honor and privilege of studying with Dr. Nagel. And I'd like to introduce Dr. Masaki and his paper on Theodore Kleefel and the revival of confessional Lutheranism. Please welcome Dr. Masaki.
Good afternoon. In his essay, The Father of the Church, Hermann Sasser once reflected, "It is always a sign of deep spiritual sickness when a church forgets its fathers. Rejoicing over every sign of a new awakening of Lutheran theology of the time, Sasser encouraged the readers to take the confessions of our church just as seriously as it was taken by the fathers of the time of the Reformation and also the fathers of the 19th century. The Walther anniversary year provides us a fitting occasion to do just that. But who in the world is a man called Theodore Kleefel? Are we not here to learn more about C.F.W. Walther? Is Kleefel relevant to our community? Can anything good come out of him at all? It is true that Sasser mentioned Kleefel as often as he referenced Wilhelm Leer and August Filmer. At times, his voice sounded rather pleading in a typical manner. Why do we know nothing, practically nothing, about the greatest liturgical scholars of our church in the 19th century, about Leer and Kleefel? But isn't the name Kleefel largely unknown within the LCMS? This essay will be divided into three subsections. First, we will observe a connection between Kleefel and the Missouri Synod, especially Walther. Second, we will sketch the life and the works of Kleefel. And third, we will examine one of his many important contributions, a book entitled Acht Bücher von der Kirche, or Eight Books on the Church. Part one. If we review Francis Pieper's Christian Dogmatics, we may be surprised to see Kleefel's name rather frequently. Even more unexpectedly, despite often attached labels about him, such as the High Church, Romanizing, and dictatorial, Pieper quotes Kleefel positively almost all the time. Pieper often disputes the view of Johann von Hofmann, behind whom he sees the theology of Schleiermacher, concerning the method of theology, a doctrine of verbal inspiration of the scripture, original sin, Christ's vicarious satisfaction, atonement, and justification by faith. Kleefel is right, Pieper repeats. And yet, Pieper leaves room for treating Kleefel negatively when he comes to deal with the doctrine of the church and the office of the holy ministry. Pieper believes that such 19th century churchmen as Leer and Kleefel teach strongly Romanizing doctrine of the ministry. Of them, it is said that they regard the office as a particular spiritual estate and another means of grace so that baptism and the Lord's Supper are efficacious because of the office. The early Saxon pastors used the same or similar argument in their criticism against J.A.A. Grabau. Interestingly, in this connection, Pieper fails to provide precise reference to Clifford's writing, except that he mentions Clifford's book, Acht Bücher von der Kirche. This only prompts us to ask whether Pieper wrote his view on Clifford and other 19th century theologians on the basis of his reading of the original writings of or merely on repeating someone else's evaluation of them from the secondary sources. Our knowledge of Clifford, however, doesn't come only from Sasser and Pieper. One of the prominent leaders of the Missouri Synod in the early years, and in fact, one of our first professors and presidents of this institution, who served from 1850 until his death in 1891, Friedrich August Kramer, was ordained into the office of the Holy Ministry by Clifford at the Cathedral Church in Schwerin on April 4th, 1845. At the ordination, Lochner reports that it was such a moving moment that when Clifford communed Kramer, Clifford made a sign of the cross on Kramer, who was kneeling, and spoke a word of the angel to Elijah in 1 Kings chapter 19, 7. Get up and eat, for you have before you a long journey. How about Walther himself? Did he know Clifford? Had he read Clifford's writings? Has he ever met Clifford? Just recently, through a weighty, I'm talking literally, weighty and invigorating book at home in the house of my fathers, I discovered that Walther did meet with Clifford and discussed with him both the church and the office. It was at the time a height of the controversy on church and office when Missouri Synod sent Walther and Friedrich Winneken to Germany to attempt to heal the growing disagreement with Lehr. During that trip, Walther spent a good amount of time at the University Library of Erlangen to complete his book Kirche und Amt. He visited not only Lehr, but also dozens of leading theologians and pastors, including Thomasius, Hoffmann, Schmid, Häfling, Delitzsch, Adolf von Harles, and Karnis, presenting his understanding of the church and office and hearing their responses. The trip of Walther and Winneken had another purpose, raising funds for the expansion of the St. Louis Seminary. This request was warmly received by Harles, Thomasius, Lehr, and others, as they also wrote letters of recommendations to the Queen and other governmental authorities, and connected Walther and Winneken to donors and pastors. Those leading theologians in Germany considered seminaries in American church to be utterly crucial for preparing preachers. Without seminaries, the Lutheran Church and her missions would never not only flourish, but not even survive. On December the 10th, 1851, Walther and Winneken traveled to Schwerin in Mecklenburg and met Clifford on the next day. They carried with them a written recommendation to Clifford that was written by Lehr. Before the meeting, Walther and Winneken had read one of Clifford's recent sermons on the way, which impressed Walther very much, as he wrote, "It had already filled us with heartfelt confidence toward him." Walther calls Clifford in this report this important man and regards him with a sense of deep respect and high admiration. The way Cuiforce welcomed Walther and Winneken was for them something which we had never dared to hope for ourselves, they said. Leia's letter of recommendation also contained a request regarding permission for a church collection in the Grand Duchy for the purpose of an expansion of St. Louis Concordia College and Seminary. Walther reports, the member of the High Consistory inquired with a great interest about our ecclesiastical position, our need, prospects, etc., and assured us at once of permission for the request articulated in this letter without us even having to say a word. This comment indicates that Cuiforce, who had ordained August Cramer 6 years before, and the Church of Mecklenburg, were eager to assist Walther and the Missouri Synod, especially the seminary. It is reported elsewhere that Chevrien frequently sent financial support for the ongoing work of the LCMS, and in fact, I also read that Cramer's mission was entirely financed by Mecklenburg Christians there. On the next day, Walther and Winneken visited Cuiforce again by his invitation. Walther writes, "We mostly spoke with him about topics regarding church governance and church order. We also received a great deal of insight about many points in this area where, as it is generally known, Dr. Cuiforce has rendered some fine work." Walther included in the following notes in this report, among others, the excellent writing, The Original Order of the Divine Service in the German Church of the Lutheran Confession, which had been was published in 1847, which was also noted in Der Lutheraner. In the foregoing report of the meeting of Walther and Cuiforce, we find no hint of negativity on either side. Walther is confident in Cuiforce's theology. Walther, who had known of Cuiforce through his writings and sermons, now met him in person. And his sense of respect toward Cuiforce has been confirmed and strengthened. Cuiforce also embraces Walther and Missouri Synod. Providing financial support means that Cuiforce considered Walther and the LCMS as his friends and common confessors of the gospel. Between the two stood Leia, who rendered a wonderful service by introducing Walther to Cuiforce, asking him and his church for help on Walther's behalf. In the report, Cuiforce is portrayed as a friend and ally of Walther and another teacher of the confessional and liturgical revival. Part 2, The Life and Works. One of the reasons why Cuiforce is still not well known in American Lutheran scene is the fact that his massive writings have not yet been translated into English. Here I'm delighted to announce that Cuiforce's treatise on ordination was recently translated by Pastor Jason D. Lane and as a major part of his SCM thesis last year, and is scheduled to be published soon by Lutheran Legacy. Theodor Friedrich Detlof Cuiforce was born on 18th of January, 1810, as a son of pastor. He studied theology at Berlin and Rostock universities. In 1833, he was called as instructor for the young man who would later become the Grand Duke of Mecklenburg, Friedrich Franz II. In 1839, he published his first book, Introduction to History of Dogma, and for this work, he was awarded the degree of Doctor of Philosophy from Rostock University in the same year. When Friedrich Franz was confirmed December 39, Cuiforce returned to Mecklenburg. After ordination, he was called as pastor in 1840 to Ludwigslust, And just last week, I learned that well-known figure among us, Dr. John Feeney, he called me saying that his great-great-grandfather, Albert Brouwer, was a colleague of Clifford, and also one of his forefathers also, Moritz Passow, that was his name. He was a pastor, a predecessor of Clifford as the pastor for the Duke's family. So we have a close connection. The same year, 1840, he was married to Agnes Walter. They would have 7 children. He founded a mission society, built schools for neglected children, and already occupied a leading position in the territorial church. In 1844, he succeeded his father as superintendent of the Diocese of Schwerin, the chief administrator of the Lutheran Church of Mecklenburg. He also became the preacher of the cathedral there. In this capacity, Clifford ordained Kramer in 1845. On the 11th of March, 1847, he was awarded for his doctrinal liturgical works the honorary degree of Doctor of Theology, both from the University of Königsberg and a few days later from University of Rostock. In the turbulent revolution year of 1848, Clifford became chairman of the newly formed Kirchenkommission to prepare for the reorganization of the church. Clifford and his fellow commissioners were able to defend the church from the intrusion of the state at the conference in 1849, with a result that they reconstructed the higher church council over Kirchenrat to undertake the actual administration of the Lutheran Church in Mecklenburg. Clifford became a member of this over Kirchenrat and secured the autonomy of the church from the state in Sacris. Walther and Winneken came to meet Clifford shortly after this time. Since 1852, Clifford represented the territorial church of Mecklenburg in the Eisenach Conference of Evangelical Church Governors in Germany. Clifford was also a regular keynote speaker in 1852-62 at the annual Liturgical Lutheran Conference in aftermath of the Eisenach Conference, which indicates that Clifford was the established liturgical scholar as well. In 1853, he declined a call to Dresden, for which his duke was thankful. And 54 to 59, he published the Kirchliche Zeitschrift, and also from 60 to 64, another journal, Theologische Zeitschrift. And both of them have been quoted or cited or noted by Lehr und Vera about 11 times, thanks to Pastor Robert Smith of our library to find out about it. Ernst Haack, one of Clifford's biographers, comments that Clifford gradually became the representative of all Lutheran-minded people, and not only from territorial and free churches of Germany, but also from Sweden and America. People turned to him for Gutachten, or opinion, on the burning issues and problems of the church. When I was at the archive, I found four pages letter asking for a Gutachten, and that was written in 1853 by J.A. Grabau, and he wrote to Clifford. Unfortunately, I couldn't read the handwritings, and there was no record of Clifford's answer, so I'm really interested in knowing what the content must have been. Maybe I shouldn't be knowing. In 1868, he founded with Harless and Lutard and others the Allgemeine Evangelische Lutherische Conference, and after the death of Harless in 1879, Clifford succeeded him as its president. 1894, he retired from the Oberkirchenrat of which he had also been the president since 1886. After he had died the following year, the Lutheran Church of Mecklenburg was free from the interference of the state. Its pastors were united in their adherence to the Lutheran confessions. The decay in its liturgical life had been reversed. So, according to Hermann Sasse, Cleophas was the most important Lutheran episcopal figure in Germany. John Kleinig considers him to be one of the greatest churchmen of the 19th century. Cleophas wrote and published on a wide range of topics. His interests went from history of the dogma to liturgy, pastoral care, ecclesiology, and exegetical works. He was also responding to burning issues of the day, such as the effect of the Enlightenment and Pietism on the liturgy, the union of Lutherans and the Reformed, the church governance issues after the Revolution of 1848, Erlangen theology, a question of non-denominational missions, higher critical exegesis, Kyriasm, Kenosic Christology, and so on. Although he was awarded three doctorates, he never occupied a professorship at the university. For him, theology was not a mere academic exercise or just private scholarship, but was always done for the life of the church. His biography extends to multiple pages. What amazes me is not only the amount and scope of his writings, but almost every work is of high quality, substantial in size. Normally, each volume runs about 500 pages, and he wrote them in the midst of a very busy schedule as the head of the Mecklenburg Church. Here are a few representative volumes in chronological order: Introduction to the History of Dogma, Origin of the Divine Service, which Walter noted, Baptism, Liturgical Essay Series, 8 volumes, one on marriage, funeral, and ordination, and one entire volume on confession and absolution, and one volume on confirmation, and 5 volumes of liturgical theology and history and practice. 8 books on the church, Scriptural Proof Against Hoffman, which is a major source of Piper, commentary on Zechariah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and Revelation, and Cantionale, the 4-volume set, and lastly, Christian Eschatology. In addition to these works, there are collections of sermons composed of at least 10 volumes in 2 series. Cleophas also published more than 70 hymns. He was a theological consultant in designing the Second Parish St. Paul's Church in Schwerin. He was involved in the life of the church by publishing Church Order, a daily lectionary, a prayer book, and a hymn book. His above-mentioned Cantionale of 4 volumes in folio size contains rich liturgical resources such as the order of service for all Sundays, daily services, prayers, and Lutheran music. Cleophas never tired of preparing liturgical sources for the church. Part 3. When Cleophas published 8 books on the church in 1854, he was a member of the Oberkirchenrat, the Higher Church Council of the Territorial Church of Mecklenburg, as he continued to serve also as superintendent of Schwerin. In 1839, Cleophas had already designated his time as the time of the church. In succeeding years, books on the church appeared one after another from many quarters of Germany. It's just too many to count. Among them were the works that bore the title Bücher von der Kirche, Books on the Church, such as Leyer's 3 Books on the Church, Delitzsch's 4 Books on the Church. Cleophas certainly knew of Walther's Kirche und Amt, as well as the works by Stahl, Häfling, and Harless. As Leyer worked on his book, when the kneeling controversy reached its climax and his young wife and 4th child had just died, And as Walther wrote his Kirche und Amt, in the midst of the controversy with Grabau and with Lea, when the memory of the Stephan's tragedy was still fresh. So Clifford wrote, he had his own immediate context when he wrote this book. He was engaging a polemic against the theological faculty of the University of Göttingen, who supported the Prussian Union of 1817. Recognizing this historical situation, however, Acht Bücher, Eight Books on the Church, should not be read merely as a reactionary work, because in this book, Clifford attempts to discuss thoroughly the doctrine of the Church. As many of his books and writings, Eight Books on the Church was not written with scholarly readers in view. Rather than focusing on theologians at universities, Clifford attempted to attract a wider audience. This work was also effective beyond the boundary of Mecklenburg, just as were his liturgical writings. Unlike Walther's Kirche und Amt or Theodosius Harnack's Die Kirche, ihr Amt, ihr Regiment, Clifford's Acht Bücher does not run with thesis and proof texts. Nor is it full of references from Lutheran confessions and the writings of the classical Lutheran dogmaticians. Rather, perhaps for the sake of intended wider audience, readership, or out of his own conviction to always start with the words of our Lord, Clifford writes mostly from the scriptures, expounding, articulating, and discoursing by using his own words and critical thinking. There are many obvious allusions to the content of the Book of Concord all the way through, but explicit confessional citations are relatively few. He seldom quotes private teachers of the Church, but when he does, he consults with the works of Luther, Melanchthon, Chemnitz, Gerhard, and Quenstedt. Out of the projected eight books, he in fact has written and completed only first four. Eight books is divided, therefore, into four books, which are found in 34 subsections. For ready reference, I have given short titles, which Clifford did not provide, for each of those subsections, and therefore I have before you the handout. Book one, in the time of the Church. In confessing the Church, Clifford does not begin by describing our need and desire for fellowship as in Lea's three books, nor does he start with the congregation of the saints as Walther does in his Kirche und Amt. Rather, Clifford's point of departure is the fact of man's sin and the salvation-creating work of the Trinity. For Clifford, the Church comes only at the point number two. Clifford divides the time after the fall into three phases: the time of revelation, the time of the Church, and the time of fulfillment. We may rename them the time of salvation prepared and accomplished, the time of salvation distributed, and the time of salvation consummated. In all of these periods, the Holy Trinity is the main character. With the epiphany of the Son of God in the flesh and his death and resurrection, the time of revelation culminates and the time of the Church begins. What is remarkable about Clifford's treatment is a strong emphasis of Christ's ascension and his sending of his Spirit. Justification of the world is achieved, but salvation now needs to be delivered to man. To prepare for the distribution of the fruits of the cross, the Lord becomes the head of the Church after his ascension and sends his Spirit to call, gather, enlighten, and govern the Church. During the entire time of the Church, the ascended Lord and the outpoured Spirit always work together, the church is at the same time the product and means of the Holy Trinity. Book 2, the means of grace and means of grace office. As soon as the Spirit is sent at Pentecost, the Lord begins to plant salvation in the world. The Lord gathers his people through preaching and baptizing and sustains his congregation through the breaking of the bread and fellowship of prayer and life. As Clifford highlights the means of grace here, he introduces two articulations, the Greek word dosis and leipsis are one articulation. Through these terms, he expounds the ways of the means of grace as giving and receiving, the literal translation, or distribution and reception. Clifford does not universalize all the means of grace into one principle, doing the same thing only in different appearances, but he confesses each of the means of grace uniquely as they achieve what they achieve. Second is a German word which I do not wish to translate for the fear of losing nuances. Das Gnadenmittelamt. The Reformation has given us the term das Predigtamt, which literally means the office that delivers a sermon. So this new term of Clifford expresses the heart of Clifford's theology, the office that delivers the means of grace. Clifford maintains that through dosis and lempsis, giving and receiving, a distinction is made between not only giving and receiving, but also between the one who gives and the one who receives. And he continues to say that God did not intend this distinction to be vague or floating about. Let us hear what Clifford had to say on the office. And please take a look at the other side of the handout. For the administration of the means of grace in this church and for its lasting service, God instituted an office of the means of grace. This office doesn't arise through the general Christian calling of all, but through the special call that mandates a sure ministry of the means of grace. The means of grace office, therefore, exists not only according to the will of God, but also through the act of God, and not through the development of the church, but through the arrangement and institution of God. God gave to the church as his arrangement the means of grace and the mandate to administer the same. And so that such mandate may be carried out, God has given and maintained the ordained office. On account of this, then, although the congregation offers the individuals for the office and individuals prepare themselves for the office at the hand of those who form them ecclesiastically, and the church exercises the vocatio mediata through her organs, nevertheless, it is truly God himself who preserves the means of grace office by always awakening and preparing the individuals for the ministry, by putting through his church, church members, into the office, and by giving them to the congregation. The importance and strength of this office, however, consists in the fact that dosis, the giving of the means of grace, is entrusted to the office. For this reason, the office is indeed not the third or fourth means of grace. Neither can it be a creation of the new means of grace either, nor strengthening and completing the existing ones. Rather, it is an instrumental service for the means of grace and is itself strong through the same alone. The office, however, is necessary not out of human or social, but out of the divine order, so that the divine blessing may never follow when the means of grace is not administered through the ordained office. From here it follows furthermore that the means of grace office calls for faithfulness and aptitude and wisdom and personal piety for the office from the ones who bear the office. However, it is not the case that the efficacy of the office depends on these personal qualities of the bearer. Precisely, it is not the person, but in the means of grace that such efficacy of the office lies. Finally, the church as a whole is a possessor of the means of grace office. The church is to supply the individuals, preserve them through love gifts, incorporate them into the organism of the church law, set in action for his purposes, look after the personal faithfulness of his bearer, and so on. However, she is neither the author nor the Lord of the office. Rather, she is to support and preserve it as God has instituted it and given it to her. Here we observe at least the following 5 points to consider. First, the means of grace office is not a human arrangement or something that has developed over the course of the church history. Rather, it is instituted by the Lord, just as the means of grace themselves have been. Clifford refers to John 20 as well as Matthew 16 and 18 over here. The distinction between giving and receiving, as well as between the giving one and the receiving ones, is inherent in the nature of the means of grace for Clifford. No gift of the Lord is bestowed unless there is the one who gives it and that the other one who is given to. No man can deliver the means of grace to or by himself. I quote, "If anyone qualifies himself for preaching and the distribution of the sacrament in an uncalled manner, unberufener Weise, he will do it to the detriment of his own soul." He also says, if the Gnadenmittel Amt were comprehended as a product and organization of the universal priesthood of all Christians, then the Lord would have instituted only a function of the administration of the means of grace with no certain and specific person given the office to carry out the entrusted ministry. Second, Clifford confesses that it is the Lord himself who puts a man into the Gnadenmittel Amt. God does not only create the office, but he also continues to preserve it by placing shepherds and teachers into the office through the mediation of the church. Clifford understands the making of a pastor to be a process, just like in Treatise of the Prime Principle of the Pope, that includes the call, the examination, ordination, and installation. But his whole point is that the entire process is truly the work of the Lord himself. Third, Clifford emphasizes that the nature of the service of the Gnadenmittel Amt to be an instrumental service. The Gnadenmittel Amt is not another means of grace, but it serves the means of grace. The point Clifford stress on the instrumental service is that it is the Lord who is actually doing the ministry. Fourth, while Clifford talks about faithfulness and aptitude, wisdom and personal piety of the bearers of the office, he carefully avoids the notion that efficacy of the work of the Gnadenmittel Amt depends on the personal quality of the office bearers. Through and through, Clifford rejects any so-called hierarchical understanding of the office. Finally, Clifford teaches that there are at least 4 things involved when he speaks of the Gnadenmittel Amt as having been given to the church. First, the church presents to God persons for the office from among her members. Second, she exercises the vocatio mediata. Third, she supports the livelihood of the office bearers through her gifts and other means. And fourth, she mentions the bearer of the office in the exercise of the word and sacrament. Briefly, book 3 and 4. In book 3, Clifford engages the topic of leipsis, or receiving, and elaborates on the gift and the task of the congregation. Clifford begins by pointing out that the foundational character of a congregation in relation to the Lord is receptiveness, femininity, and being a bride. The congregation is gathered, receiving what is given, and bearing fruits. A congregation does not depend on the faith of the individuals, but on the preaching of the gospel and the administration of the sacraments. Quifos writes, I quote, "It is not that where two or three believers are, there is a congregation. But where God works through the means of grace, there are believers and so the congregation." Although lapsus depends on doses, the right administration of the means of grace does not automatically bring about a flourishing congregation, just as Augustana 5 confesses it in the language of where and when it pleases him. The congregation of believers is the priestly people of God who are given to do the priestly service in the various priestly ways. The priestly service does not consist in bringing mediating sacrifice for sin and guilt, but in giving back to God his whole life as full Eucharistic sacrifice in prayer and good works. In relation to God, the priestly people are given free reception of him and his holy gifts. They are one with him and governed by him. In relation to each other, the priestly people seek common interests as they grow together in service to each other. And in relation to the world, the priestly people pray for it, give witness to the grace of God in Jesus, and do good works for the neighbors. So the current threefold emphasis is all there, are all there in Quifos. The priestly service of the congregation in prayer and good works are not accidental or optional. And these services may be done partly through the established offices in the congregation that are distinct from the means of grace office. Quifos call them as diaconia, or simply Gemeindeamt, congregation office. Book 4. For Quifos, the church order and governance are not about building bureaucracy or hierarchy. His understanding does not come primarily from the law's two ways of governance either. Instead, the ground of his consideration of the church governance comes from how the Lord mandated mission and edification. In this connection, Quifos asserts that the church is a living organism. For Quifos, the church is not best described as a total number of believing souls or a society or a pile of believers who are united by their resolution to do some arbitrary common activities of their own choice. Rather, the church is the body of Christ that keeps receiving the Lord's gifts and keeps living out of those gifts in the church and the world. There is a movement of the gospel, the dynamics, and this is suggested by the term organism. Just as each Christian is given particular callings, so the church as the body of Christ as a whole is given a common vocation of mission and edification. The church order has its purpose, the providing of guidance to each member of the church to do the common vocation according to one's own station of life. In order to understand the church order, Quifos explains that there is an authority of the church government. This authority does not flow out of the authority of the state, but from the authority of the church. On the other hand, the church governance is not identical with the means of grace office. Quifos wanted Christ to govern the church. For him, the order of the Lord's salvation was above the order of the church. Go to conclusion part. In this essay, I have attempted to introduce Theodor Quifos as another confessional voice from the 19th century Germany. Since he is largely unknown in our church, I thought it vital to present his contributions in theology and the church together with his connection with Walther and the LCMS. We cannot finally fully evaluate his theology and the revival of confessional Lutheranism through him in just one paper like this. But at least if some of us are prompted to want to investigate him and his writings, I am delighted. There is still much more investigation to be done on his ecclesiology, liturgical theology, preaching, pastoral theology, history of dogma, biblical studies, missiology, and eschatology. In him, we discover faithfulness to the scripture and the Lutheran confessions in a way a little different from how we are accustomed to read them in Walther and in our tradition. We saw that Cleaforth and Walther were friendly to each other. In them, along with Winneken, Leyer, and Kramer, and other leading voices of the 19th century Lutheran fathers, we find a common legacy. I continue to be amazed at how passionate and stubborn these men were in the Lutheran confessions. Of course, they were Germans and the missions. I like to follow that tradition as a Japanese. I drive a German car. Only Volkswagen. In the midst of such diverse and extraordinary challenges and difficulties, these 19th century fathers had such a burning heart for both. Or we should perhaps say that for them, it was one and the same thing. To be confessional Lutherans meant for them, to use a modern term, to be missional. To be missional meant to be confessional Lutherans. As a result, they all shared an extraordinary sense of the critical vitality of the seminary education. What is there to do with the challenge or charge that Cleaforth had a strong Romanizing doctrine of the ministry, that for him the office was a particular spiritual estate and even another means of grace? We only had a chance to briefly look at one of his major writings, Eight Books on the Church. But it was clear, I think, that Cleaforth did not hold such a view. What then was characteristic of his theology? Certainly there are a number of ways to illustrate it. But in Eight Books, Acht Bücher, what stood out were dosis and leipsis, giving and receiving, and Gnadenmittel Amt. While Leyer, in his Drei Bücher, emphasized the distinctiveness of the Lutheran Church, and Walther, in his Church and Office and other writings that followed, was interested in the rights and the duties of congregations as original possessor of the power of the keys. Cleaforth's way to approach ecclesiology was through the dynamic flow of the gospel in the Lord's giving and the church's receiving. From the beginning, Cleaforth faithfully confessed what is at the center of the scripture, sin and forgiveness. By making a clear distinction between giving and receiving, and the giving one and the receiving ones, Cleaforth extolled both offices of the Gnadenmittel Amt and Gemeindamt or Diakonia. He knew that only when such a distinction is made, may one uphold both offices appropriately as the Lord has intended. By focusing on the Lord's gift giving, Cleaforth was resourced to confess the vitality of that gift in the life of the church in common vocation of mission and edification, and in prayer and good works. Even his understanding of the church order and governance was subordinated to the means of grace doctrine. The task of the church governance was to liberate the church from the tyranny of both sacerdotalism and congregationalism, for it is the ascended Lord who is the Lord of the church. If it is true that Walther is best understood when understood in harmony with the confessions, then we might want to say that Cleaforth is best understood when understood with the dynamic flow of the Lord's dosis giving and the church's receiving. We studied our essay with the words of Hermann Sasser. It is always a sign of a deep spiritual sickness when a church forgets its fathers. We may want to add to the list of our fathers a name, Theodore Cleaforth. Thank you very much.